Radio 360.
In the studio, I've got screenwriter and off-Broadway comedy playwright Paul Rudnick over here, and Jesse Green, the co-chief theater critic of the New York Times. Jesse wrote an article in the Times headlined, "Will the Old Gay Play Have Something New to Say?" And amid this sudden glut of revivals of gay-themed plays in New York, it was about how gay characters and themes have evolved on the stage and how they do or don't hold up a generation or two or three later. Jesse and Paul, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt.
So we're going to talk about a bunch of the plays, especially from the 80s and 90s that you wrote about, Jesse, in your article. But let's go back. Before there were plays overtly about gayness, there were obviously gay playwrights writing what were certainly since have been regarded as elliptically, cryptically gay plays, like Tennessee Williams' Streetcar Named Desire, or Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, or Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's the first time I remember hearing as a child, like, no, that's really about homosexuals, Kurt.
He will strike you down from the grave.
I know he will. I know he will.
His estate will go after
him. I know he will. So, and Williams didn't like the idea of writing for a gay audience particularly.
That was a less credible position.
Yeah. So Albee objecting to that, Williams not wanting to be considered a gay playwright, was that legitimate? Was it a function of when they were writing? Both? What?
There was a lot of gay baiting that went on back then because Albee and Tennessee Williams, two of the great iconic American playwrights, were often criticized and accused of disguising gay characters.
At the time.
At the time. And so also, remember, the cost of being openly gay then was unthinkable. They would not have had the careers they had. They would not have had any careers at all.
Were there advantages, do you think, for writers not being able to deal explicitly with gay themes? Was that an interesting constraint in the 1940s and 50s?
I think that's kind of a false perspective because it somehow says, there were more universal themes before people were writing about more marginalized lives. So I think that's kind of unfair. And also, especially in the case of Williams, it was interesting the way he managed to work gay characters, and especially in something like Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, so that they're clearly, these guys did want to write about these topics, but it was forbidden. So I can't think of it as an actual helpful constraint.
I both agree with that and disagree with that, and you're a working playwright, so you should know. But there is a way in which I think all writers thrive under constraints. Any kind of constraint, whether it's word length or how long your play can be or how many sets you have money for in this
production. Or the Nazis occupying Paris. I mean, that is a thing,
As a good example. So you could argue that had some of these playwrights been free to say everything they wanted in exactly the form they wanted, they may not have found such fabulous workarounds.
But again, you would have to say, oh, gee, would August Wilson have been better off had he been forced to write about white people? You know,
I think he'd have been better off if he'd been forced to write about gay people. I just think that was his real métier.
I think you're joking.
Yes, I am.
But you see, on radio, like online, deadpan humor doesn't always come across as
noted
deadpan humor. So let's move forward in time to the 60s and especially the 80s and 90s. I want to go through a few of these and talk about which ones you like more and less, how they struck you when you first saw them, how well you think they hold up now. And we've got, for many of them, clips from the movie adaptation so the audience can play along at home.
There you go.
So, Boys in the Band, written by Mart Crowley, who's still alive, by the way, and first staged in 1968. Jesse, give the listeners, if you would, a brief synopsis, introduction to this classic.
A bunch of extremely unhappy gay men meet for a party in which they play a devastating game and basically reveal the emptiness and tragedy of gay life. Do you think that's fair, Paul?
It's interesting. I think it is completely valid, but I would also say that my early experience of that play and of the movie, which I thought probably how I first saw it, was probably at like a college film society. I thought of it as far more joyous than that, that I think it is absolutely true that it is a kind of a tragic vision. It's also a very funny play, very smart, and doesn't advocate for the tragic vision. I think by the end of it, it says, no, we have to stop hating ourselves. So that sometimes it gets an unfortunate rap as being anti-gay, which it isn't.
Let's listen to a clip from Boys in the Band.
Oh,
Hi, darling. Connie Casserole. Oh, Mary, don't ask.
Hello, Emery. Put that in the kitchen.
Okay.
Hello, Hank.
How are you?
I would be the first. No, you're not. Lipstick.
Who is this exotic woman over here?
Hi, Emery.
My dear, I thought you'd perished. Where have you been hiding your classically chiseled features?
I don't live in the city anymore.
Emery, where's your gift?
Oh, it's arriving later.
Wow. The split between the Straits and the Marys was already so well established.
And by that, we mean what, Jesse?
The straight acting gaze and the effeminate acting gaze.
That was interesting. I remember seeing it, and it was the first explicitly gay anything I'd ever been aware of.
It terrified me. I saw the movie first, and if I had been out of the closet, it would have scared me back into it. I agree with Paul that it's not endorsing anything anti-gay, but it is presenting such a tragic picture of the current state of affairs, probably fairly accurately
right.
at that, that it wasn't exactly, you know, welcome and rainbow flags.
Right. How did it play to gay audiences and straight audiences at the time in the late 60s and early 70s?
Oh, well, it was an enormous success, both the play and the movie, and they were considered explosive and scandalous, but it was very highly praised and ran for quite a while. So there was a slight sense of a forbidden glimpse at a subculture. On the other hand, because I think it was written by a gay man and written very knowledgeably and wisely, that it wasn't just a lurid peek. There was really a sense of, okay, these lives exist, take a look. So it was a breakthrough, and you can't, I always think that can't be diminished, that I think Mark Crowley did something that was, especially at the time, incredibly brave. And lastly, because I know it's going to be revived next season, directed by Ryan Murphy, I believe, or at least produced by him.
Directed by Joe Mantello.
Oh, Joe Mantello, on Broadway.
Produced by Ryan Murphy.
Exactly. Ryan Murphy, who did direct the HBO version of The Normal Heart, is someone who includes massive amounts of gay, straight characters, you name it.
So, next, let's talk about Harvey Fierstein's Torch Song Trilogy. Paul, you were a fan.
Oh, enormously so. That was it was and is a magnificent play and is being given, from everything I've heard, a top-notch revival starring Michael Urey, who is just a world-class actor. And so I think, I remember Harvey starring in it, which was
so
magnetic.
Did you see it when you were a young man?
I did indeed.
And 1981?
I adored it because... Both because it was wonderful to see gay material on stage, but even more so because it's such a terrific play and was so funny and so beautifully performed.
Tell the listeners the basic idea of Torch Song.
Torch Song was, I think, taken somewhat from Harvey's own life. It was about a drag queen making his way in the world and his romantic life, his relationship with a bisexual partner, and ultimately in the third act with his mother, who was not forgiving and not accepting. So it becomes quite explosive by the end. But it was a very wonderfully positive portrait of gay lives and of this outsized, irrepressible, irresistible guy.
Right.
And yet still a portrait of gay lives that were struggling with basic identity questions. This would gradually change so that gay characters could appear without having to argue their right to exist
right.
or to be out of the closet. But at this time, Fierstein really zeroed in on those issues.
I think my biggest problem is being young and beautiful. It's my biggest problem because I've never been young and beautiful. Oh, I've been beautiful. God knows I've been young, but never the twain have met. Not so as anyone would notice anyway. You know, a shrink acquaintance of mine believes this to be the root of my attraction to a class of men most subtly described as old and ugly. I think he's underestimating my wheedles. See, an ugly person who goes after a pretty person gets nothing but trouble. But a pretty person who goes after an ugly person gets at least cab fare. Now, I ain't saying I never fell for a pretty face. But when les gens sont faits, give me a toad with a pot of gold and I'll give you three meals a day. Because, honeys, ain't no such thing as a toad when the lights go down. It's either feast or famine. The daylight you gotta watch out for. Well, face it, a thing of beauty is a joy till sunrise.
That is Harvey Fierstein, of course, in the film adaptation of Torch Song Trilogy. Jesse, are you old enough to have seen it when it was playing the first time?
I saw it when it was put together as the trilogy. It had originally been done as a series of one acts off Broadway at La Mama and elsewhere, and then was put together as a one evening, very long event.
Do you expect, and again, being reminded of it from that clip we just watched and heard, that it will hold up and be perfectly relevant in 2017-18?
Oh, absolutely, because I think it was interesting how prescient a lot of, because Harvey in that play just deals with the possibility of gay marriage, gay adoption, how you create a family.
Really?
So, yep. And that play also won the Tony for Best Play, if I recall.
Also, it's so character-based. It's really about
this guy, this entertaining, lovable guy.
And the relationship between him and his mother, which is, you know, will that ever not be topical?
So it seems to me, tell me if I'm completely wrong about this, but that period, that dozen years, are a kind of continental divide in gay culture, gay theater, suddenly out, suddenly the horrors of AIDS. I mean, that was the before and after moment, is that true, fair?
Well, AIDS certainly was the dividing line for many things in gay life, including what happened to gay theater. I mean, of course, using the phrase gay theater or gay plays has, right. is a problem in itself.
Right.
And often redundant.
Well, perhaps in your case.
You had it in your headline.
I am not responsible for my headline. The way AIDS functioned in the larger questions of gay life, a terrible tragedy that affected pretty much everyone in the community one way or another, but also, sad to say, was the first thing that fully convinced non-gay people that there were real lives worth mourning and treasuring behind, you know, those shadowy figures they had heard about for years. And so through plays about AIDS, the doors came to open for other plays. But at the time we're talking about, that was just beginning to happen with plays like The Normal Heart and Falsettos. And
As Is.
And Jeffrey.
And Jeffrey.
We're next going to Larry Kramer's play The Normal Heart. 1985, Paul.
It was shattering and it was important on so many levels because at that time in the early years of the AIDS crisis, the media was not covering any of it. There was no source of information. And that
And it's really early years. It came out in 1985. I mean, the first New York Times article was 1982, I believe.
Exactly. And even that was relatively minor. There was an electricity when you went to see that because nobody knew what was going on. There were certainly no medical answers, and there was no government attention whatsoever. So it was making a difference on so many levels. And I think what, especially the most recent revival revealed, although this was pretty much acknowledged already, it's also a terrific play. It really works. It cooks.
And here is a clip from the film adaptation of The Normal Heart, Mark Ruffalo starring.
I am beginning to think that you and your straight world are our enemy. I am furious with you. And every goddamn doctor who made me feel it was sick to love a man. I am trying to understand why nobody gives a shit that we're dying! $5 million for a house we can't even get 27 cents from the city? I know 43 guys who have died and you say it's my cause, not yours? You still think I'm sick? I simply cannot allow it for one single second longer. I will not speak to you again until you accept me as your equal, your healthy equal, your brother.
One of the signal tones of The Normal Heart is the rage. That represents a perfect meeting of playwright and topic at a particular time. Larry Kramer.
Who was a big, loud activist and remains so.
And founded Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP before being kind of pushed to the sidelines of both of them because of his large personality, shall we say. But in this play, there was no one to push him aside, and he successfully channeled a kind of biblical rage into a dramatic form that still holds up. In fact, I think that's what actually continues to make it viable as a play. Had it been less political, I don't think it would continue to hold up.
And what about the fact that AIDS can now be managed very differently than we had any idea back then that it ever would be or could be. Does that change dramatically the way that that play is watched today?
I find it irritating to say the least when people say, oh, it's dated. And I think, first of all, AIDS is still prevalent all over the world. And thank God it's dated to the extent it has. And aside from that, the minute you say, oh, a play was set in an earlier age, therefore we should have no interest in it.
No.
Well, let's erase all of Shakespeare then. But What I've experienced is when younger audiences experience these plays, they've thankfully not had to live through that right. particular tragedy, but they are fascinated, and it is also historical information for them, right. and they had no idea.
Because it's like a war movie made during the war.
It is a yep. war movie. That's exactly yeah. right.
So now let's talk about Tony Kushner's great Angels in America, which appeared in the early 1990s and then in the early aughts became an HBO miniseries. For people who missed it or have forgotten, Paul.
Summarize that, Paul.
What is Tony Kushner's play about?
Well, all you need to basically know is it's a masterwork. It's one of the truly great American plays, and it's an epic. What was the subtitle that Tony put out?
Gay Fantasia on American themes or an American Fantasia on gay themes.
Yes, because it was set in the age of AIDS with wild flights of fantasy and beyond, that it involves everyone from Roy Cohn to Ethel Rosenberg to the lives of a central gay couple, one of whom is suffering quite terribly from AIDS and the other whom is running away from him. So it's both a very personal story and deeply emotional, and it's about everyone and everything.
I saw an angel weeks ago. I did. I saw her. I did. I'm not insane.
I didn't say you
were. I saw an angel. That's insane.
Well, it's
insane, but I'm not insane. But then why did I do this to myself? Because I have been driven insane by your son and by that lying. Because ever since she arrived, ever since, I have been consumed by this ice-cold razor blade terror that just shouts and shouts, keep moving, run, and I've run myself into the ground. Right where she said I'd eventually be. Really, she seems so real.
That's Justin Kirk and Meryl Streep in Mike Nichols' adaptation of Angels in America. Did you both see the play when it opened on Broadway in 1993?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you couldn't not see it. It really was thrilling. And it was also the introduction of this of the genius that is Tony Kushner, so that you got both the action of the play and also the lyricism and the poetry and the humor, everything else that you thought, oh my God, this is a major writer who's arrived in full flower. So it was beyond an event. I mean, I don't think I can't imagine anything that's equaled it in the years since.
Right.
I had seen an early version of it in San Francisco where it was done at the Eureka Theater, I believe. And it was done on two nights, and I think it ran to about 400 hours. it was not yet cut down to its very modest 8-hour length or whatever it played on Broadway in two evenings. And it wasn't finished, but you knew that something, as Paul said, a new voice, new to most of us, had emerged, but also a way of looking at the content that had been bubbling around in a lot of the plays that we'd been talking about, reorganized toward a different purpose and with an enormous vision that went way beyond AIDS and gayness to encompass really the whole
modern history.
Modern history and future history, because looked at now, I find myself very drawn to the part of the story, and amazingly, it's just one part of the story that is about the future of the planet.
So we all agree it's the great play of its era?
Oh, it's that good. Yeah, right. I know.
A great gay play, by any means. It's a great
American
play.
Oh, it is a great gay play.
Yeah, it's both. I imagine that Tony Kushner would insist on that as well, but that it certainly is in the canon. You know, when you talk about Death of a Salesman and Streetcar Named Desire, you put Angels in America right up there.
And interestingly, compared to most of the other plays, all the other plays, I guess, we've been talking about, it is not thoroughly realistic. It has these poetic flights of fancy and angels and dead people and so forth. Does that make it less dated?
Yeah, it's not dated in the slightest, because even though a lot of it is a particularly specific attack on Reagan in those years, that doesn't date either when you look at, okay, how do those years inform what's happening right now?
Right. And the central story, which is about betrayal of one character for his lover and his having to figure out how to make his life okay after he betrays his lover, that's another
pretty
story
universal.
That will never, never go away.
Paul.
Yeah?
Let's look at one of your best-known plays previously mentioned, Jeffrey. Here is a clip from the movie.
I mean, look at us. Look at how happy we are. Don't we make you want to fall in love?
Sometimes I think we should be on a brochure for Middle America. Then everyone can say,
Oh, look, a wholesome gay couple.
Oh, excuse me. You two are not wholesome.
You're a decorator. Excuse me, an interior designer. And he's a dancer. You two are like Martha Stewart and Ann Miller. Which, believe me, I prefer. I just hate that gay role models are supposed to be just like straight people. As if even straight people are like that.
That is so true.
Oh, thank God, Paul. Thank God for that play. Really,
oh,
I remember...
thank you.
No, in the
Sir
midst
Patrick
of...
Stewart and a couple of other actors whose names you probably know.
That was Stephen Weber and Brian Datt. Brian originated that role in the original production.
But Paul, you're interrupting your own compliment.
Go. Keep going.
We had to ID. Go.
Gosh.
You know, in the midst of all these plays we've been talking about, not a one of them a comedy, mind you, and also in the midst of a time of terrible sadness, came a play which was an AIDS comedy, possibly? Can we call it that? I mean, I don't know if you ever called it that, but something that...
It's a genre. Now,
well, it's a genre of one.
That really did
one of the things that theater can and should do, and it was something no one else was, I want to say, daring to do. I don't know if it felt daring to you, though.
It was only possible because of plays like The Normal Heart, because the subject matter had been treated with the weight that it deserved. But I was a comic writer, and for a while I thought maybe there was no way into this material and into the subject, but I couldn't help myself because all the people around me were so funny. And before there were any medical possibilities, a sense of humor was kind of the only weapon anyone had.
So now, are gay characters being more mainstreamed in the fact that they're gay becoming secondary in plays?
To a certain extent, but I think there's one funny thing that's kind of going on in the theater right at the moment, which is because of gay marriage being legalized, which is a big win for the LGBTQ world, it makes gay people no longer underdogs. And a lot of writers have been wrestling with, okay, we can now write plays about the troubles of gay marriage and gay relationships, which seems a little beside the point after you've had that particular victory. So it's an interesting challenge. But there's still a sense, especially when you leave the coast, that if you have a play where there's a central gay character, where there is a LGBTQ hero, heroine, you name it, that will still be questionable. That will be seen as a niche item. That, yes, you could still have plenty of gay best friends and gay aunts and uncles, but if it means it, it will still be produced without the frequency of August Osage County, which is a fantastic play. But there could still be marginalized things going on.
But on the other hand, you have the surprising success of a musical like Fun Home, which is the story of a young lesbian discovering her identity. And this is a musical that not only succeeded on Broadway, but is now doing very well on the road. So go figure that one out.
Well, I was just going to ask about that. And I think of the play Indecent. Suddenly you have lesbian stars, characters on Broadway. But only in the last few years. Why such a lag in terms of gender?
Exactly, because also Lisa Krohn, who did the book and lyrics and won Tony's, I think, for both on Fun Home, is a superb writer who had wonderful solo shows and another great play on Broadway called Well that she appeared in. So yeah, I think there is a lag because I think the culture, also because AIDS was seen as affecting gay men directly, there was a natural output
more
there.
More dramatic.
Yeah.
Do we think, if we regathered here in 25 years, that we wouldn't look back at this age of the gay play as a kind of specific golden age, that like 1970 to 2000 will be a period of the great gay theater, partly as a result of dealing with AIDS?
Yeah, I think there was a natural flowering that is indisputable, that you often have art in response to a world crisis. And also because the art was very restricted at that time, there were not a lot of movies that dealt with AIDS and no TV shows or very few.
Right.
So and theater also because it was affecting the theatrical community so immediately. Yeah, I think those plays will be...
And pre and post... legal gay marriage seems to me to be a huge cultural thing.
Oh, absolutely.
I think you're right that we will be able to see this discrete portion of time in a certain way. And perhaps what will happen is that gay playwrights, whether or not they're writing about gay characters, will have their work just sort of flowing into the mainstream of all works at that time. And, you know, one day I think you're right, we will look back at this as a time when plays about gay characters flourished because gay people were not flourishing elsewhere.
Jesse Green and Paul Rudnick, this has been deeply illuminating and enlightening and entertaining for me. So thank you both.
Thank you, Kirk.
Thank you. You're a good straight guy.
I do my best. You can judge for yourself how some of these plays we've been talking about stand up decades after they were written. Torch Song has had an off-Broadway revival that's about to end. But then Angels in America begins performances on Broadway in February, and Boys in the Band comes to Broadway in April. You can find out more about all of these productions at our website, pri.org/studio360. That's pri.org/studio360.